Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an analyst speaks with us about rising tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Even if an attempt is made now to try to cool the tempers, it may be too late.
Our senior economic editor discusses tumbling stock prices around the world. Ranchers take a stand in the U.S. West. And we remember the contribution of Grammy Award-winning singer Natalie Cole. Coming up right here on The Voice of America. Saudi Arabia's allies curbed their diplomatic links with Iran today, following Riyadh's decision to sever its relations with Iran after protesters stormed the country's embassy in Tehran. Bahrain and Sudan cut their diplomatic ties to Tehran, while the United Arab Emirates downgraded its relations with Iran, limiting the number of Tehran's diplomats in the country and reducing the representation to a chargé d'affaires rather than an ambassador. The heightened tensions came in the aftermath of Sunni Saudi Arabia's execution Saturday of a leading Shiite cleric, Sheikh Namir al-Namer. After Riyadh announced his execution along with 46 others, angry Iranian protesters smashed furniture and set fires at the Saudi embassy in Tehran, with demonstrators also attacking the country's consulate in Mashhad. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal says tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia have simmered for a long time, and there is no mechanism for a cooling down of the dispute, which he warns could lead to a fundamental instability in the region.
It becomes very important under these circumstances to try to cool the tempers on both sides, and that will require external forces coming in, because in neither of the two countries are there any domestic forces which will try to seek moderation or try to solve this problem in a peaceful fashion.
The United States is urging diplomatic engagement and called for leaders throughout the region to take affirmative steps to reduce tensions. But is that going to be enough?
No. Fundamentally more. And tell you why I'm saying this. Because this has been building up for a long time in the region. And as you know very well, that the Daesh, the Islamic State's movement, actually began in retaliation to an absolutist Shia government in Iraq, and which tended to essentially marginalize the Sunnis, who are a fairly significant number and not a very small minority in that country. And that has built into increasingly a Shia-Sunni conflict. That being the case, and now the same thing happening in a place like Syria, and for that matter in Yemen. So the trouble that you see is that even if an attempt is made now to try to cool the tempers, it may be too late, because there's just too many centers of gravity now in the system where these kinds of tensions have now matured. And because they're matured, they've taken a life of their own. For that reason, simply making a statement or asking for diplomatic effort to resolve the problem doesn't work. You have to go well beyond that. And that would mean two things. One, try to resolve the strategic problems that exist in the region, which have spawned things like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and others. We may not like it. We certainly will not like it, because that doesn't fit in with the U.S. objectives and interests. But the reality is, may not be the case in the short term, but in the long term, it's in our interest to seek durable peace in the area. Otherwise, there will be problems. So for that reason, we may have to think substantially more. And that means a very clear-cut timetable, a framework to solve the underlying political and strategic problems that exist in places like Iraq and elsewhere, which will then tend to reduce the tension between the Shia and the Sunni. And when that happens, then it will be possible to reduce the tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia, remembering very well that these two countries have ascribed to themselves the right to lead the Shia or the Sunni extremists. It has to stop. The only way it can stop is if there are fundamental changes in our policy towards the region, which will allow for the legitimate interests of the various parties in the region to be accepted, recognized, and worked on.
Zubair Iqbal says Riyadh carried out the mass executions, mostly of Al-Qaeda operatives, with full knowledge of the reaction it would likely provoke. He says the executions and the reaction to them represents a further deepening of the Shiite-Sunni divide in the region that cannot be resolved from within the Middle East, but rather outside the region. For more on how the Saudi-Iranian dispute is unfolding on social media, Michael Lippin joins us in the studio. And welcome, Michael.
Hi, Susan. Hey,
what hashtags are people using?
Well, I've seen a couple of big ones so far. We have the hashtags Iran-Saudi and Saudi-Iran. So you've got the inverse there. And there's also hashtag Saudi executions relating to the executions of the 47 people that happened recently. And you also have hashtag Sheikh Nimr and hashtag Nimr al-Nimr. That is the name of the Shiite Saudi cleric who was executed by the Saudis. Now, here are a couple of tweets that I've seen with the Iran-Saudi and Saudi-Iran hashtags. First one comes from Abuzar Hadavand. He is a PhD candidate in economics at the City University of New York. He says, the list of countries cutting ties with Iran shows where the Saudi money has been flowing recently. And those countries, of course, include Bahrain, Sudan, and the UAE. Here's another tweet from Abdul Rahman Sajjad. He describes himself as a Pakistani patriot. He says, settle down your relations. This is talking to Saudi Arabia and Iran. Settle down your relations, otherwise your enemies will take advantage of it. Hashtag wake up call to Muslim countries. And one more tweet from Sumitha Kuti, who describes herself as an associate research fellow at the S.J. Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore. She talks about Bahrain cutting ties with Iran, and she says, whoa, what a surprise. A satellite state proving that it's just that, a satellite state. And of course, she's making the insinuation that Bahrain is just a satellite of Saudi.
So I hear there are some cartoons about the Saudi-Iran dispute also making the rounds on Twitter. What have you seen, Michael?
Well, these cartoons are not very kind to the Saudis. There's a cartoon that's been going around showing an ISIS fighter with a knife raised and a kneeling, blindfolded prisoner about to be beheaded. And alongside that, you see a Saudi holding an even bigger sword against a kneeling, blindfolded prisoner. And, of course, the implication is that they're one and the same. The headline over, the caption over the ISIS fighter says, barbaric death cult. And the headline over the Saudi executioner says, friend and ally. And that, of course, is making the point that the Saudis are friends and allies of America. And one Twitter user said, the hypocrisy is utterly astounding. The hypocrisy of supporting one side, the Saudis, that execute people by beheading, and ISIS, that also executes people by beheading. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The ninth of the 18 segments that will become the primary mirror for the new James Webb Space Telescope has been put into place. The new Webb Telescope is the more powerful scientific successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. Working inside the gigantic clean room at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, engineers and technicians recently used a robotic arm to install the mirror segment. Each of the hexagonal-shaped pieces measures a little over 1.3 meters across and weighs about 40 kilograms. When completely assembled, all 18 mirror segments will work together to form the telescope's large 6.5-meter primary mirror. NASA expects the installation of all mirror segments to be completed sometime in early 2016. The rocket that will carry the new space telescope into space is set for launch on October 2018 from the Guiana Space Center in French Guiana. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The U.S., Chinese, and European stock markets took a big plunge first thing today. Our senior economic editor, Jim Randall, is here in the studio to help us understand why. Well, welcome, Jim, and dare I say Happy New Year?
Well, you can.
So, Jim, what's this all about?
Well, I think it's principally, there was some data about China's manufacturing, which was yet again disappointing. And I think investors looked at that and said, here we go again. Here's another disappointing report on the Chinese manufacturing sector, which is large and important and so forth. And even though the Chinese government has worked very hard to try to boost economic growth, it doesn't seem to be working. And so I think investors were shaken by that. And so stocks plunged in China. That's 7%. They dropped so much so fast that authorities stepped in and stopped trading for the day. It was they call that the circuit breaker thing. And that happened, and that worried other investors. And so you saw other stocks in other important Asian markets like Hong Kong and Tokyo. They also dropped sharply, not quite as much as in China, but a lot. And U.S. stocks at the opening and in the first hour or so of trading, they were down pretty sharply. They were down 2% for the Dow and around the same for the S&P. And the NASDAQ was down even more.
Well, can you remind us of some of these other little problems we've been seeing in China's economy?
Well, China has grown enormously at an enormously fast pace for many, many years. And so for them to slow down to only, 6-point-something% growth, which is way faster than most other nations, is a problem for them because they've kind of gotten used to this very strong growth, and so have the people who sell things to China and buy things from China. So when China slows down, it's the world's second largest economy. So problems there ripple through the rest of the world economy pretty quickly and can hit pretty hard. And China is trying to switch from this manufacturing economy, which is bumping into a ceiling. They can only make so much stuff and sell so much stuff because there's only so many places to sell it. So they've got to switch from this manufacturing economy driven by investment. They're trying to change to a consumer-driven economy. Where Chinese people buy products, maybe made in China, maybe made elsewhere, and that will drive the economy. The U.S. economy is like that. It's about two-thirds driven by consumer demand. China wants more consumer demand because a lot of very smart people figure that's more sustainable over the years and the decades.
Well, we have another big story today, the Saudi Arabian-Iran situation. How is that affecting our oil markets?
Well, it's causing them to be quite volatile. On the face of it, when two major oil producers are are having a real dispute and very angry, and they're regional rivals anyway for religious and strategic and tactical reasons, that raises worries that somehow or other that might slow the flow of oil into the global market, and we have less oil and relatively steady demand that causes prices to go up. But at the same time, pulling the other way, the sign that China's economy is slowing down, that could push oil prices down. Because when China's economy slows down, other economies slow down. When the economies, large economies or a bunch of economies slow down, that cuts demand for oil, and that tends to cut prices. So what we know about the price of oil is that it's likely to change.
Oh, well, it's like they say in the movies, fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Jim, for stopping by.
Happy to be here.
Coming up on International Edition, an old-fashioned standoff in the U.S. West, and a musical tribute to an unforgettable singer. Protesters say they are armed, have occupied a remote wildlife refuge in Princeton, Oregon, over the reincarceration of two ranchers convicted of setting fires that spread to federal land. The original sentences were lengthened during an appeal process, and that sparked a protest march and the occupation of the officers of the Molly Ure National Wildlife Refuge in support of ranchers Dwight Hammond and his son Stephen. Protest leader Eamon Bundy, who was involved in a similar standoff with federal authorities in 2014 over grazing rights in Nevada, says they are demanding the release of the two ranchers and are reacting to what he calls government intrusion into the rights of private property owners. In Colgren, a reporter for the Oregonian newspaper in Portland, has been following the story from nearby Burns, Oregon, and spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty.
That's not to say that the issue is not of great importance in eastern Oregon. It absolutely is. This is an issue here between ranchers who want to make a living on the land and the federal government, which wants to kind of be the steward and protect that. So there's always a give and take with that out here.
Well, a lot of people must realize that an awful lot of territory is actually controlled by the federal government. It's not privately owned in the West.
It is. More than half of the state of Oregon, land area-wise, is controlled by the federal government.
Now, this issue traces back, according to the Associated Press, to the 1970s, and what was called the Sagebrush Rebellion, a move by western states like Nevada to increase local control over federal land.
There are disputes that come up and are resolved between local ranchers and the federal government last year was whether to list the sage grouse, the kind of bird, as a protected species by the federal government. And many ranchers were worried that would really hurt their way of life and not allow them to be able to ranch the way they always have for, you know, some of them for a century. And in that case, the federal government did not list the bird at the end, and so it was a big win for the ranchers here. So there are little instances like that that come up all the time. This, of course, is certainly more pronounced and related to constitutional issues as a whole, at least in the eyes of the people who are occupying those buildings.
What kind of interest do you see? Is it primarily local? Is it national? Is it even international?
It is definitely international, I'd say. When this story broke last night, I was in the office, and I was alarmed at how fast it spread really across the country and across the world. It's something that is a very salient issue to a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. You know, the federal government's role in our lives, law enforcement's role in our lives. I saw a lot of people kind of drawing parallels or trying to compare how law enforcement has handled this, which so far has been completely non-existent. When I was out at the compound today getting a tour from some of the militia members, there were no police there. There were no police there at all. And there are people drawing parallels. Well, you look at the Black Lives Matter protests. How is that handled differently? I mean, there are all sorts of these issues that are really salient, I think, in our country right now that are getting drawn into this.
Ian Gulgren says the occupiers insist that they have both the resources and connections to stay at the refuge site for years. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Grammy Award-winning singer Natalie Cole, the daughter of jazz legend Nat King Cole, is dead at the age of 65. International Edition's Steve Norman looks back at her life and career.
Unforgettable, the near or far.
Like a song of love that clings to me.
Unforgettable, written by Irving Gordon, was recorded by Nat King Cole in 1951, the year after his daughter Natalie was born. It was a huge hit for Nat, and an even bigger hit when Natalie Cole recorded a virtual duet of the song with her father in 1991, 26 years after he died.
And forevermore.
A statement from the Cole family said Natalie died Thursday at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles from ongoing health issues. The statement said Cole fought a fierce, courageous battle, dying how she lived, with dignity, strength, and honor. In quoting her most identifiable song, the family also said, "Our beloved mother and sister will be greatly missed and remain unforgettable in our hearts forever."
Ooh,
Natalie rose to musical success in the mid-1970s as a rhythm and blues artist with hits like This Will Be.
Just how much you care. You've given me the thrill of a lifetime and made me believe you've got more thrills to spare. Oh, this will be an everlasting love. Oh, yes, it will now.
Even with her success in R&B and pop music, Natalie Cole's career always remained wrapped around her father's. Nat King Cole died in 1965 when Natalie was away at boarding school. The two were very close, and throughout her career, Natalie Cole paid tribute to her father by creating virtual duets like When I Fall in Love.
And the moment I can feel that, you feel that way too, is when I fall. Or I'll never fall in love. In a restless world like this is, love is ended before it's begun. And too many moonlight.
Thank you for joining us today.
Seem to cool in the warmth of the sun.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States on December 19th expressed disappointment in the process followed by the government of Rwanda to call a referendum on short notice to amend the Rwandan constitution. Among the amendments considered were those introducing exceptions to presidential term limits. In a statement released December 19th, National Security Council spokesperson Ned Price said, "While we commend the people of Rwanda for peacefully exercising their civic rights, we regret that the arrangements for the referendum failed to provide sufficient time and opportunity for political debate on the merits of the proposed provisions." The United States continues to be concerned by long-standing restrictions on peaceful assembly, association, and free expression in Rwanda. The U.S. urges the government of Rwanda to enable the full and unfettered exercise of these fundamental freedoms as the country moves toward local elections in 2016, presidential elections in 2017, and parliamentary elections in 2018. The peaceful transfer of power from one leader to another is the hallmark of stable, prosperous democracies. President Kagame, who in many ways has strengthened and developed Rwanda, now has an historic opportunity to enshrine his legacy by honoring his commitments to respect the term limits set when he entered office. By doing so, President Kagame would help to more firmly establish a credible foundation for long-term democracy in Rwanda, reinforce the substantial progress that has been achieved toward sustained peace and prosperity for all Rwandans, and set a laudable example not only for Rwanda, but for the region and the world. As U.S. President Obama has stated, great leaders throughout history forged a lasting legacy not only because of what they did in office, but because they were willing to leave office and transfer power peacefully. The United States remains committed to supporting the people of Rwanda in their effort to ensure a strong, stable, democratic, and prosperous future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.